Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast which is allegedly about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld. I'm Milo Edwards, someone who's never seen Seinfeld, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host Phoebe Roy.
Hello.
That is all she ever says. And this week we're joined all the way from my right. It's Australian comedian, all-round good fellow, Luca Muller. How
Hello,
you doing?
Hello, folks. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
I know. Veteran of this podcast.
It must be almost a year to the day, probably.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Our annual little bit of...
Yes.
Little bit of Luca Muller on the...
Every April I get a little go. No, it's great to be back.
Yeah. In Melbourne, we can hear a tram going past. It's all happening. Yeah, so this week we are talking about it's season 9, episode 17, The Bookstore. It's a literary episode of Seinfeld,
which is our favorite. It is indeed.
It's for the readers. I can't help but notice, Milo, when I came into your little accommodation here, you've got a copy of Infinite Jest in a stereotypical fuckboy. You would have loved the bookstore parts of this. You would have felt right at home in these scenes.
Yeah, that's right. You're being a bit unfair
to Milo there, because like as far as I can tell, he just has a copy because he's making collages out of the pages. So
it's part of his crafting. I actually use it to hide a gun inside, so the hollowed out pages.
And then inside the gun is another copy of Infinite Jest.
Yeah, it's a hollowed out gun.
Yeah. It's one of those Looney Tunes ass guns where you shoot it and a flag unfurls, but it has all of Infinite Jest on it.
You ever seen one of those like Bibles where they're like ludicrously small, like the text is printed really small? Like you could fit one of those in like where the magazine would go in a handgun.
Or it's like one of the, you know, like in like Pulp Fiction or whatever, where they have the briefcase with the molded foam thing for the guns. They open that out and then like they open up the guns and it's got like a copy of, I don't know, fucking Ernest Hemingway in there.
Yeah.
Because you need to hide your Hemingway.
If anyone's got
a
book in one of those like foam like gun suitcases, it's got to be like a Jack Reacher or an Andy McNab or something. You know, I feel that'd be the ultimate, the tactical dad's book of choice. Tom Clancy.
Any Neeson character.
Yeah.
Personally molded.
Absolutely. Yeah, Liam Neeson, what a great niche. Just like he's always like a gardener whose wife has been kidnapped and it's called like The Rake or something.
Yeah. He's in the new Naked Gun, did you know? He's been cast as the Leslie Nielsen character.
Wow. I can't imagine comedy Neeson.
I know. What a bizarre, and in a way, like he's funny. He's an inherently funny entity, you know what I mean? Like, it's funny that he exists and was Qui-Gon Jinn and now makes these endless action movies the way he does. Yeah. And now he's doing this, but I can't picture it. I can't imagine it.
I can only do a Liam Neeson impression of him doing one line in Love Actually where he goes, "That was fantastic! Classic drumming, son!" And that's how I picture Liam Neeson saying "classic drumming, son" to his... Because also, like, canonically, it's his, like, stepson whose mother has died. There's no indication as to where the real father of this child is.
He is his stepson, isn't he? Because he says at the funeral, my lovely wife and Sam's lovely mum, which strongly suggests...
Yeah.
That's
and it's
not...
odd. Like, why write that in? Because it's not... They don't make anything of it in the... He's just like treated as the kid's real dad for the whole. So why bother writing in that pointless detail? I think sometimes people forget that fiction writers are making all this stuff up.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, well, he just happened to be his stepdad. Like, no, none of these people are real. Like, they chose to do that for no reason.
Maybe it was a big plot that got edited out. The divorce and Liam Neeson arriving in the kid's life. They didn't get along at first.
Yeah.
But then eventually it's a classic drum song.
There is a whole edited bit out of Love Actually, which is the kid doing like some random gymnastics stuff like at the airport. Like there's an insane long version of that scene where the kid is doing like like Jackie Chan style backflips over like airport security and stuff. It looks really insane.
I think the editor made a great call on that one, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, it really took on a kind of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon thing for this one scene for no reason. But we're not here to talk about Love Actually. God knows one day we might be. It's the sort of thing we might talk about on this podcast. We're here to talk about Seinfeld.
Would you like to know when this episode was aired?
Please.
And some facts about the day.
Act me up.
Some associated facts about the day. So it was aired on the 9th of April 1998.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, spring. We're getting into spring. Spring 98.
Yep.
And we have two early deaths on this day. We have John Tate, who was an American boxer, mm-hmm. who died from a stroke at 43. I feel like that's quite a regular way for a...
Yeah, punching in the head's got to be a factor there.
Yeah. It's just probably not that good for you.
Either that or all the sugar he was eating, because being from the Tate family.
Yep, either that. Yeah. I mean, we don't know.
They just used to eat it straight out of the back. That was their family tradition. But it did have horrid health consequences.
And then we have another early death, which is slightly more cloak and dagger, which is the death of Tom Cora, who was an American cellist and composer who died at 44. We don't know what he died of.
Ooh.
Just says he died.
Yeah, you don't get hit. He died at 44. That's
when you're playing the cello.
Yeah.
I think you should do. I think it should be part of it.
Yeah. It would be fun to like murder a cellist, like hypothetically, and like garrote them with the bow or something, you know, like an appropriate death. Get them with the spike on the end of the cello.
I think that's how they should determine who has first chair in the orchestra. Just make them fight. It's
part
of it.
The death.
Yeah.
Like not to the death, but definitely to the near death. Yeah. Definitely to the near death.
Like an orchestra of the toughest. Britain's hardest orchestral musicians.
It feels like this is primed for a movie adaptation. There was Bradley Cooper's, what's that called? Maestro. And then there was Tar a couple of years ago. There's this resurgence of like, people aren't into classical music, but they're into the idea of it. I'll watch a movie about it. I'm not going to go to the symphony, but I'll listen. I'll think about it for a little while.
Oh, yeah.
Don't play me any of the music, but I will I will get very, very interested in the kind of in the rigors of being a conductor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we need like the cellist tar is what you're saying.
Yeah. This could scratch that itch for sure.
Yeah. Maestro was a good movie in the sense that it was mostly about a guy who had a wife, which I respect.
It's a big genre these days.
Yeah. It fakes you in. You think it's going to be about a guy who's a musician. No, it's about being a wife guy, which, you know, it's a way of life I respect. Yeah.
So yeah, that's all we've got for the 9th of April, 1998.
Fair enough.
A quiet day, happily.
Yeah. Well, we're still in Fukuyama territory in 1998. History hasn't kicked off again, you know.
Yeah, true. We're in a gentle little period.
Yeah, well, between the Falklands War and September 11th, 2001, pretty chill.
They've been in the special room, sort of shaking the box that contains history around, trying to get it started.
No one can work out
how to get to the fuse box to just turn everything on and off again.
They briefly had a history exhibit in museums because they're like, well, this is the stuff of the past.
it's just pretty relaxed. Lots of inflatable furniture, lots of jewelry shaped like aliens.
And the alien in a pot. Of course. Yeah.
Can I start with a hot take about this episode of Seinfeld?
Please.
I'm sorry if this isn't allowed. I don't think this is a very good episode. I think it's quite a bad episode.
It's not a great episode. It's a little bit of a filler episode, I think.
Mm.
I quite like Jerry's storyline. I think it's quite a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of them are not really up to much.
No, I feel like there's this sort of collective idea, and I think Seinfeld's even spoken about it in interviews, saying that, yeah, we could have kept going. We could have kept going for ages. We got offered a huge amount of money to keep doing more seasons. They wanted it, but I knew it was time. I didn't want to push it past. I think he knew that it was on the downhill, that he was running out of juice.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's loads of season 9 that I think is terrific, but there are one or two, I suppose, like quieter episodes, much like the day of this episode release. It was just a quieter day in 1998. It is an entirely unromantic episode. Nobody has any date, or rather, I suppose Elaine kind of has a dating plotline. I quite like Elaine's plotline. I think that's quite a fun one. But it's not really quite enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even then, it's not quite romance, is it? It's strictly physical.
True. But it's sort of a dating storyline. I think what it is an episode which is made up of like not entirely satisfying snacks.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you sort of go, oh, a little snack, but you're not feeling like kind of, oh, what a delicious sweet treat from the bakery.
Yeah, it's a small plate.
This is our lunch yesterday, Milo.
Oh, yeah.
We tried to go to a place for lunch. The place was, their kitchen had shut. We ended up, I mean, it was fine.
Yeah, we got Melbourne'd in a big way. It was 3 p.m. and they were like, you can't eat lunch at 3 p.m. Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
Some kind of Arab? What is this? We eat lunch at 11 a.m. as God intended.
Between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., it's pieces of salami on bread and pickles for you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. It was pretty good, but it was,
I think the Kramer storyline was the pickles, the most disappointing part of the whole meal, I would say.
Yeah, you know what? I actually think that with the other three storylines on their own, they're not quite meaty enough, really, for a really kind of like trad three course Seinfeld. They're not like a kind of you know, preemie antipasti secundi situation of a Seinfeld episode. Yeah. It's more kind of like little bits.
Some leftovers arranged together.
Little kind of, yeah, little bits. It's a bit of a picky tea. But I think that the other storylines would be fine if we didn't have this. We didn't have this Kramer storyline, which I agree with you, Luke. I really, really don't. I really don't care for it. I don't think it's.
Well, Kramer and Newman are just predicting the centre of London now.
I mean, the only funny bit really is that they predict the return of the rickshaw to the Western city centre, which is sort of, you know, which if they'd come up with that idea in 1998, they would be, you know, they'd be trillionaires. But the actual storyline, it doesn't feel very Seinfeld-y. It feels more kind of...
Jokes about homeless guys being weird and insane and saying non sequiturs like potato salad. It just doesn't feel in the oeuvre of Seinfeld. It doesn't.
It doesn't. Like the... because I think people make the error of saying like, oh, well, like the issue with Seinfeld is about, you know, these horrible people behaving horribly, which is true, but it actually isn't socially very horrible often. It's not kind of it's not so horrible on a kind of wider scale. It's more focused on the kind of intrapersonal villainy of kind of not very nice middle class New York people, as opposed to, like, it doesn't, I don't want to use the term punching down because I think it's been overused and has sort of lost all of its meaning, but it doesn't really do that. There's very, very little, the joke is that they're homeless. But in this episode, the joke is that the homeless men involved are homeless. Yeah. That's the joke.
Down,
that's it.
Who punches down? You punch across.
That's the whole joke. That's the whole joke. And so I think the rest of them, they're like I said, they're slightly thin, but it would be a perfectly all right kind of, you know, filler episode. Like a piece of connective tissue. It's like a bit of cartilage. It's not muscle. It's not fat. But you'd miss it if it wasn't there. But I think that the rest of it gets undermined by the bad Kramer storyline. That's my position.
Yeah, the others aren't so weak, but their foundation that they're built on is shaking them about.
Stony ground.
I've not watched Seinfeld in sequence for years and years, and so I don't remember. But I feel like Jerry's kind of off in this episode as well. Is this part of some longer arc where Jerry loses his mojo and isn't funny for a few episodes or something.
Yeah, and they have to send Jerry back to the 1960s.
Yeah, because the Skanko Roman wrestling line really stood out to me as like a bad,
oh, come
bad
on. Seinfeld.
And then him saying to the idiot mobile when Kramer and Newman like go to, you know, sort out whatever homeless men they're going to abuse for these rickshaws or something.
Yeah, there's a real that occasionally like they'll put something into Seinfeld which feels like it's been written in as a zinger.
Yeah.
And those are never the ones that zing. Which is ironic because Seinfeld has itself parodied this concept with the George episode where it's like the idiot store.
yeah.
And yet they've put in unironically Skanko Roman wrestling.
Yeah. And it gets I think Elaine gives him an eye roll or something like that. But outside
she
of
does.
That.
She gives him a sarcastic clap.
Yeah.
For that. So at least you are supposed to think that it is not a very good zinger, which is something.
You got to respect a sarcastic clap.
You must. But yeah,
she more makes a face which indicates a sarcastic clap. It's more like
what's great about the sarcastic clap is people know you're being sarcastic, but they can't prove it.
Yeah.
You can deploy a sarcastic clap in almost any situation and get away with
it. Yeah, yeah. I was just trying to start an applause. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Forgive me, please.
At a funeral, great place for a sarcastic clap.
I thought this is what happened as they went in, as we lowered them down.
Just one man doing that slow. Or better yet, doing the clap you would do before doing the long jump.
Yeah, yeah. Building the pace as it gets closer to sea level.
Before running and jumping over the grave ceremonially.
I do love the cold open on this episode though.
Yeah, that's a fun. What is that, a dream sequence or is that just
a quick bit of sketch comedy? It's just a little bit of sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Which you don't normally get to see. So that's a little bit of a treat. That's like, if we're going to go back to the small plates analogy, that's like a kind of a, oh, you know what? This sounded like it was the most uninteresting thing on the menu. It sounded like a kind of sort of non-specific dumpling thing, but this is actually one of the best things I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
Remind us of the opening skit. These always leave my head immediately after watching.
So the cold open is a sketch where Kramer is left on his own in Jerry's flat for an unspecified period of time. But I suppose you're supposed to think it's the course of an evening because Jerry says, Jerry says, "I've got a show. You're just going to hang out."
Yeah.
And then in a kind of time lapse, we get to see what Kramer does in the apartment when Jerry's not there. So he's riding his bike around. He's inviting people around. He's dressing up as Jerry and doing an impression of Jerry and saying, "What's the deal with politics?"
And I do that in my own apartment. So.
Well, exactly. I assume that's how you rehearse, no?
Yeah. A terrifying piece of foreboding for Michael Rich's own future stand-up career in that moment.
And he's doing all this stuff, he's making a mess, etc., etc., etc. And it shows him it is a small shot of him leaving a glass of juice or something on a table without a coaster, and then it shows Jerry getting back with no awareness of what Kramer has been doing in his apartment this evening, and he sees the drink and he's like, God's sake, and puts a coaster under it because that's what he thinks is the issue of what's been going on behind his back. And the reason I like it is because it reminds me of one of those, like, you know, those like kind of like Far Side star like comics.
Yeah.
Where it's stuff like, oh, what your cat gets up to while you're away. Mm. And it's literally, and it's like the cat, like, and it's the cat, like, holding poker nights and kind of political rallies in your house. And then when you come back, and the cat's just asleep on the sofa, and that's what it makes me think of. And I think it's really good. I think it's really fun. And
Kramer is kind of like a cat. He doesn't work like for a living. He consumes, and yet he's quite difficult. He charges into a room before leaving.
Yeah, agile. Physically impressive.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's a good cold open. I agree. It's almost more. It's almost like an amuse-bouche rather than a dish in the meal. You know, it's a fun little surprise at the start.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't expecting this.
There's a little bit of tuna with some fig on top.
little kind of palate cleanser.
Well, there's a tiny, tiny toad in the hole that we've been given here.
It's a it's the smoked potato soup, but served in a shot glass. Ooh. Ooh, lovely little item there.
I was out with Olga for lunch the other day, and we ordered some tacos in this place to share. But one of the plates of tacos, for some reason, came with a mug of soup. And we were just like, how are we going to share this mug of soup?
Oh, for the dipping. People love the dipping tacos these days, I think.
I don't think it was for dipping. I think it was for, like, a kind of miso soup type thing, like, to have before, but, yeah.
Did you go sip for sip?
Yeah, we did. We had to go, back and forth. Back and forth with the mug of soup.
Slurp by slurp.
Yeah. The Mexicans low-key do love a soup. It's not something they're renowned for internationally. Mm-hmm. But.
Yeah, we like focusing on their hard foods, don't we?
Yeah.
The harder the better. Nachos, top of the food chain.
Oh, that's a really hard food. I would say a food you could describe as almost jagged.
Yeah, sharp, dangerous in its hardness.
Nachos, so people, one of my
people
least
are sleeping
foods.
On the Mexican soft foods, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the stuff lower down the Mohs scale.
Yeah.
You know. It goes a lot lower than ceviche. We're talking soup. It
goes all the way to a pre-taco soup, for goodness sake.
Yeah. It goes lower than guacamole.
Some of these things are so soft and wet that you just can't even conceive of them, these Mexican foods.
Some of it's just a gas. Pretty low down. So basically, Kramer and Newman's plotline, as we've alluded to, is that they set up a rickshaw company. Because Newman has imported a rickshaw from China. But unfortunately, they discover that rickshaw is very hard to pull.
He's imported one from Hong Kong. And there is a funny line about how Kramer wants to get over to Hong Kong before it goes back to China. And Jerry says, you might want to get on that. Because that happened the year before.
Yeah.
But then, of course,
they cut out the whole scene where Jerry explains about the 50-year transition policy agreement that the Chinese government signed to maintain sort of British rules and customs.
Well, they cut out the whole scene with Alexa Chung handing Hong Kong back.
Yeah, they had that bit with what's his face was actually a guest star in this episode before it was cut. The guy who was the last governor of Hong Kong, whose name I've now forgotten.
Chris Patton.
Oh, yeah.
What a pull.
Yeah, this is great. I knew Phoebe would have that on deck. I've spent long enough with this woman over the years. I'm like, she's gonna whap that straight out as soon as I mention it. Yeah.
I think the episode could have used that aspect. It would have brought some much-needed texture to the rickshaw storyline, I think.
It would have brought a Simpsons kind of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of guest stars before the homeless guys.
Yeah. One of the homeless guys is played by like Eddie Murphy for some reason.
Yeah.
So they try and hire these homeless guys to pull their rickshaws. They find the homeless guys to be unreliable. And then they try and pull the rickshaw themselves, but they discover that actually the rickshaw is pretty hard to pull, especially uphill.
Well, one of the homeless guys steals the rickshaw.
Yeah.
As well.
Which is a form of unreliability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
It's kind of the nacho of unreliability. It's at the top of the scale of severity.
Another joke I didn't like in this was, the idea of it is good, but it feels so rushed and unwritten in the way that sometimes you're guilty of in stand-up, but where they're saying we should have taken some collateral from the homeless guys so that he had reason to return the rickshaw. And then the joke is, you know, like his bag of plastic bags or his other bag of plastic bags, which is like, it's too jokey of a joke for Kramer to say, you know what I mean? He's not meant to be a wit like that.
No. Yeah, Kramer would have come up with something more baroque.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I think Jerry would say.
Absolutely. That's Jerry's wheelhouse.
Yeah,
right
if
there.
It, yeah, if it, like, it feels like Kramer should have said like, oh, his collateral could have been, well, his freedom, Jerry. That's what he likes. Mm-hmm. He wants to feel the air of the city on his skin. You can't take that as collateral, or words to that effect. I think that's the line that Kramer would take.
That's right. Kramer would regard the homeless as having an inner wealth.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Or he'd be like his keys. We could have taken his keys, and Jerry would be like, his keys, Kramer, and he wouldn't understand why it's the keys isn't a real option. We've punched up Seinfeld finally.
Finally, we'll feed this back.
Yeah.
When they air this again, there'll be some There'll be that weird thing where like the mouths are moving, but not in time with the words because they're punched in a bunch of dialogue.
I guess let's talk some highlights. It's always a treat to get a bit of Uncle Leo time, isn't it? It's always a pleasure, never a chore.
Yeah.
Love to see Uncle Leo.
So Uncle Leo's new thing is shoplifting. Mm-hmm. And apparently I was reading based on one of the riders had been reading about how there was a huge spike in elderly people shoplifting.
Really?
And apparently this is still, I've heard about this in the, it, this continues today, that elderly people are like among the major shoplifters. I think partly boredom and partly just like they just forget that they've taken stuff off the shelf or whatever. It's like it's quite a common thing that old people shoplift.
But they do make a joke about that with Leo, and he sort of says, "What? No one's going to say anything. I'm an old man. I'm confused. Will you take me home?"
Yeah.
So maybe they're just pretending.
Yeah. And Jerry's parents admitting that they also shoplift. They steal batteries. That's funny. I'm on board with this as a storyline.
Yeah, and Jerry is so shocked by it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I remember their reasoning for stealing batteries was very funny. But I can't remember exactly what it was. It was something along the grounds. There was like, they had some moral argument of why you shouldn't pay for batteries specifically.
I think it was like that they run out so often. Yeah. Things are always running out. You always have to buy new ones. And then Jerry's mom has a funny line. She goes, well, sometimes he forgets to steal them, so I have to. That's just some classic meat and potatoes Seinfeld gear.
I think it's contaminated by the homeless rickshaw storyline. There's nice stuff on your plate, but if there's like one bit that's like a bit moldy, mm-hmm. you're gonna feel gross about the rest of it, even if the rest of it is fine.
Look, I apologize that I ordered the lutefisk for everyone to share. I thought that everyone would like it. It's turned out to be a bit of a chore. It's ruined actually the atmosphere in the whole restaurant and the whole place stinks.
It's just out of place. Yeah. This is for some people, but it doesn't belong in this restaurant, for goodness.
Yeah. Like people in Scandinavia, people who've learned suffering from an early age. It's so funny that the people of Scandinavia are so rich, but they like doing things that are so unpleasant.
We deserve some suffering.
Eating rotten fish. Like having a sovereign wealth fund and eating rotten fish is so funny. Like you can afford normal fish.
Very easily.
Yeah, you're known for your fisheries.
What about, I like that this recalls an idea of a bookstore that I don't remember ever being real or have never witnessed, but the bookstore that sells coffee and has like little chill out zones and stuff. I feel like this was a big thing in the 90s and was a cultural reference point. Like
we have this in the UK.
Really?
Yeah, like Waterstones will quite often have, if it's like a big Waterstones, they might have like a Costa coffee like on the top floor and there'll be like some chairs and stuff.
And is the idea that you sit down with a little book and have a read before you buy it, or it's just part of the ambiance?
No. Like I think what Milo's referring to is something a bit different. That's like more like kind of franchises sort of stuffed together in one building. But what it is true, in the late 90s, there was a thing with like sofas and like a kind of either a coffee machine or a kind of coffee, you know, like a kind of coffee counter that's actually in the bookshop and is part of the bookshop. And yes, you are encouraged to sit down with a book. There's an episode of Black Books, which is talking about that as well. So it definitely was a thing.
To get through, like Infinite Jest.
Yeah, for example, this has come up twice this week because Hussein told me that he took it on the plane to Australia because he thought, well, this is a really really good time to finally tackle Infinite Jest.
Did he tackle it?
No, of course not.
I didn't tackle anything on the plane to Australia that time. I was in the toilet mostly.
Oh, yeah, really?
No, because you were too ill.
I had like norovirus. Yeah, it was real bad. I was tackling the Man, the aeroplane toilet is one of the worst places to have the shits. I'm going to... I mean, better than the aeroplane cabin, but worse than almost any other toilet. With the world's most pathetic tap. Like, you're really trying to get a solid hand wash going in that scenario. Oh, yeah. Under the dribble of water.
And you hate the time pressure of the aeroplane toilet as well. Like, is somebody out there? Are there... How many people are in line waiting for me? Yeah. And when you're... squatted in there for a while and you've got a long wipe ahead of you and a long hand wash, just the pressure builds and builds and builds.
Oh, it's really no good. I hate it when people knock on a toilet door.
Oh.
Especially when they knock more than once.
Yeah.
And you've already responded. And it's like, well, I'm still in here, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even better is when they
slipped out the back door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When they try and open the door more than once, but like not knocking. It's like, why are you trying the door again? I'm obviously like, it's not.
Yeah, I'm not keen on the handle rattle. I'm not keen on that.
No.
But I think that's better than the knock. And the reason I think it's better than the knock is that for whatever reason, I've lived for a while, and I have still never managed to hit on an even remotely dignified and non-panic sounding way of being like, "Fuck off! Someone's in there! Someone's in there!"
You never respond in your normal voice, do you?
No. You always respond in this kind of panicked, high-pitched voice, like not only like someone is maybe going to open the bathroom door while you're still in there, but like maybe like a number of people with like weapons and maybe a battering ram are planning on trying to eject you from this cubicle. And so you end up just going, there's someone in this. You should be able, as an adult, to just clearly, confidently say, there's someone in here.
Who goes there?
I'm nearly finished, or I will take as long as I take. Leave me alone.
When I'm trying to get someone out of the toilet, I adopt Caesar's tactics in Gaul, and I start constructing another toilet around the outside of the toilet that they're currently in.
Yeah, you got to do siege warfare on the toilet. You got to start building a ramp.
Yeah, lighting a fire at the base of the door.
You've got to starve them out.
They're only thinking about one orifice. I'm a step ahead.
My friend Blake told me a horrible story once of him in a public toilet and somebody knocking on the door of it. And it was one where on the outside there was a cubicle and then you could... Mm-hmm. On the outside, sorry, there was a urinal and then there was also a cubicle in there. Somebody knocking on the door of the cubicle while he was in there. And it's not like he dilly-dallied or time wasted, but he wasn't super rapid about his getting out of there. He looked at his phone for a little while longer and then eventually left. But the person, when he walked outside, an old man, like in his 80s, was having to squat over the urinal and just having violent diarrhea into it because of his dilly-dallying in the cubicle.
The most expensive Instagram scroll he ever did. What do you say to that man at that point? Like, what is the eye contact like?
Yeah.
Violent diarrhea into a urinal.
It's like, this is a lot of the responsibility for this rests on my shoulders.
Yeah, Phoebe, you're doing the sort of face that Emily Maitlis does while listening to like a horrifying story of neglect on Newsline. It's like very like that kind of like serious journalism face, like, yes. Truly, truly a shameful thing.
Yeah. I picture Blake looking at the guy like Oppenheimer when he first sees the first test of the atomic bomb. It's like, what is the impact of my actions? Yeah.
That's just made me think of in primary school one day where we were just like in the classroom and the someone had taken a shit in the urinal in the, because the way a British primary school is laid out is like every classroom will have its own toilets like kind of in the corridor, because some of the classrooms are arranged like end on end, so you would have to walk through another classroom to get to like the main bit of the school, and then there'd be like toilets in between each, and these were our class's toilets, so someone from our class had obviously shit in the urinal. And then the school caretaker came in holding the shit up in a black like bin liner bag and just walked in and just went, "Who did this?" And it just had the vibe of like, you know, like a Germanic tribe holding up a Roman centurion's head or something. Like, yeah, it was good stuff.
Oh, man.
At least airplane toilets don't speak to you like the ones on trains do now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't care for that.
Have you used these Exaloo public toilets that are dotted all around Melbourne, the blue and silver ones?
No, I don't think I've even seen them.
They play you a tune while you're in there. They play you a piano cover of What the World Needs Now by Burt Bacharach.
Fuck, you know what? I have used one like that in Sydney.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was playing like smooth jazz.
Yeah, that's what it's
it
all
was
about.
Very alarming.
Do they all play the same song?
I think so, yeah. But they seem to change it like on a 6-monthly basis. But right now they've got What the World Needs
Now. And right now it's What the World Needs Now.
Yeah.
Do you reckon it's like the logic of those, you know, those restaurants that play like drum and bass because they want to turn over the tables quickly and they know that A, it's annoying and B, you'll eat faster. So like there's certain music which like people will evacuate their bowels much faster.
This is the real brown note.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You go in there and like you think you're just going in for a piss, but then the Burt Bacharach starts up and you're like, maybe this is a number two situation. Yeah.
anyway, happened on Seinfeld. Oh yeah, because George takes a shit with the book is I think how we probably got to this.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he takes the book in the toilet and then they're like, you have to pay for that because it's been in the toilet. This is of course greatly offensive to Costanza's sensibilities, so he sets out on a journey of vengeance and restitution. Mm-hmm. He wants reparations from the bookstore. He tries
I like this Costanza storyline.
Me too.
I think it like with the when he's trying to give it back and there's it's been flagged in some unspecified way, but I enjoy the idea.
It's on like a no-fly list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't love the it feels like a rushed ending to the ep to have the manager come out and go, oh, I'm meant to be making an example of someone over shoplifting, so I just have to get someone in trouble. And very quickly, Jerry goes, well, does it matter who it is? Does it have to be Uncle Leo? And so he dobs in George. Mm. I don't love that it comes together so quickly like that. That's also very un-Seinfeld, I feel. Normally, you'd get a seed planted for that earlier in the episode. Yeah. But I do love the George. This is just some real textbook Costanza scheming and planning, isn't it?
Yeah. If I got snaked by my supposed best friend like that, man, there would be trouble.
I mean, I've said sorry, Milo. I just think you need, I just think you need to pay for your crimes. That's all. I think it's the best thing for you.
Which are many.
Did you ever shoplift? Have you ever? Were you peer pressured to do it when you were younger?
I haven't really. I mean, I think I've done it accidentally a couple of times, just like walking out with, like when you've like actually mostly paid for stuff, but you've just like forgotten that you had something that you put in like a weird place or whatever.
Yep.
And then I think like as a kid, a couple of times when you're like really young and you don't really quite understand the concept of a shop.
Yeah, yeah.
And your mum's like not paying attention enough to prevent you from doing this.
She's more of a threat than the security guard or the workers. You're like, if she doesn't notice me pocketing in this chocolate bar, then who cares?
Oh, 100%.
It's all mine. Yeah.
And then also like being a child, like then you discover that you've shoplifted and then you're like, fuck, I'm going to prison.
Yeah.
They're going to be passing me around in there. I can't defend myself. I've seen the TV shows. People like me can't hack prison.
4-year-old boys.
I have once shoplifted deliberately in my entire life. Uh-huh. And it was when I was a teenager, and it was a really like kind of Gollum-y thing to do, because I was like I was buying some stuff in one of those shops where they have like a kind of display of like cheap rings like next to the cash register.
Right, yeah.
And just at the last minute, I just got this like hankering for one of these rings. And I just sort of went, and kind of.
After all, why shouldn't I?
After all, why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I have one of these rings? And I stole it by kind of waving my hand across and sort of just closing round one of them more or less arbitrarily. And then just kind of spiriting it away. And I thought, I can do sleight of hand. This is amazing. Because I did this kind of.
You could have stolen a whole rabbit if they sold those in Claire's accessories.
Yeah, I did this kind of like, new ring. and then I never wore it because it was just this sort of cheap piece of tat. But I did feel very cool. when I was sort of wafting my hand over this display.
Yeah, it was a power trip.
it never occurred to me that the reason that I was not, that I was not kind of spotted and challenged was, or rather it didn't occur to me at the time because I was like 13 years old. It didn't occur to me at the time that the, like the girl behind the counter was like, was working minimum wage retail and she didn't give a shit. Like I could kill someone in front of her. She didn't care. Oh, but, yeah. So I just thought I, you know, I was, I mean,
she would have been pretty surprised coming from you, but nevertheless.
I mean, admittedly, yeah. But you know, so she, that she thought I was this kind of, you know, this sort of mysterious kind of cat burglar, but it was probably just that she saw me and didn't care.
Yeah.
Probably you, that. Particularly because it's like, it's quite difficult to ignore a teenager who is kind of hunched over, impishly kind of chuckling over their new shiny thing, going like that's quite difficult to ignore.
Yeah, yeah, that is tricky. Yeah, and it does make the court case a bit open and shut.
Yeah, a little bit.
Exhibit A, the defendant's laugh.
Exhibit B, this posture. How can you forgive this?
Yeah. Have you shoplifted?
I shoplifted once or twice, or sort of out of peer pressure when I was a teen. Just a couple of
times on the way here.
A chocolate bar here or there, stuff like that. Yeah. But I had a great hustle going. So I worked at a supermarket called Woolworths in Australia when I was a teenager. And it was at a transitional time in the Australian tobacco industry. I don't know where the UK and stuff is with this, but Australia used to just have, you know, like any product, they could have artwork and the name in whatever font they wanted. Right, and then at some point, a law was passed where you're not allowed to have any sort of enticing artwork or fonts or names or anything on a cigarette packet. They all have to be the same uniform brown color with the same font, the same size, just with the name of the cigarettes.
Ours are now like this, but I think it's more recent here.
Yeah.
It is in Australia.
So this would have...
Or rather, I am here, which is Australia, but by here, I mean the UK. The place I usually am.
So this would have been, I guess, 2009 or so, 8 or 9, something like that. Yeah. I would have been 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. But part of all of that was that you also like weren't allowed to display them in any way. You can have a board with the prices, but you can't see even these plain packaging cigarettes.
Yeah, and which is like, what's the point of the plain packaging then?
Exactly. If people are getting them, then they say they're not going to change their mind because of the boring package. But an extension of that was that you also, people weren't allowed to see you like restocking even the cupboards behind the obscured bit. And so a weird detail that we only had to do for a couple of months was you would have to like sort of empty these boxes of cigarettes into just a brown pillowcase and then sort of like hold your hands inside that brown pillowcase and obscure from the public eye you putting them into the display stand. You know what I mean?
Like a reverse burglary.
Yeah. Incredibly bizarre.
So, the mole burglar has left us his cigarettes again.
Like, what's that teenager doing at the cigarette counter boxing inside a brown
the
pillowcase?
The Lambert burglar has visited us once again.
Yeah, God forbid people see a cigarette packet or even a cigarette packet being put onto a shelf before shutting a cupboard on it.
Oh yeah,
is a really strange.
I mean, that's a real gateway drug. Yeah. I don't even smoke anymore. But if I saw somebody stacking a shelf with some, because they're all fitting together, all nice and tessellated, I'd be like, you know what? Actually, give me 60 of those.
Five of those, please. I don't even care what it is, but it looks so beautiful
exactly.
on that
what,
shelf
like,
there.
Whatever. You choose the brand. I don't even care.
It tessellates. It stacks beautifully. What a great product it must be. Yeah, I'm interested.
Phenomenal.
It must have looked as if you were like trying to like kind of calm like a kind of angry ferret just like kind of rummaging in this bag while it...
Like, yeah,
please,
it looked exactly like those bags
please,
you see people
you're
like.
In a bag. Think it's night. Think it's night.
It's nighttime in the bag. Come on now.
It came well, that's really quickly how you calm today. All those packs of cigarettes.
So that they'll go gently onto the shelves.
Yeah. Exactly. That's actually why they have to close the cigarettes in to keep it dark so they don't get uppity.
But it made it very easy to steal cigarettes because you could just leave one in the brown pillowcase and as you're transferring that back to like the behind bit of the shop, you just slip it into your pocket and stole a lot of cigarettes that way. So sort of shoplifting, but very much from the inside.
So it actually helped teenagers, you, get into smoking?
100%.
That's great stuff. I did know a guy. Actually,
I don't think you could. I don't think you can do this. I don't think you can do this anymore. But in the glory days of the Reading Festival, they used to not check your big shopping basket at the big Iceland and stuff. So you could just
they just
eyeball it. So like you weren't really stealing because you were doing it with their full. It was more kind of like. It was ethical stealing because they were doing it with their full consent. There was no lying involved.
Yeah. Stealing from supermarkets is always pretty ethical.
100%.
Oh, yeah, no. I was just making a joke on being like, this is the ethical non-monogamy of shoplifting.
ethical non-purchasing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I did know a guy at sixth form who, as a matter of principle, used to steal something from the Tesco Express every single day.
I think it's totally reasonable.
Something of like minor value, you know, like a stick of gum or whatever. And then one day he got caught and he got like, basically like picked off the ground by this gigantic security guard and taken out the back to like a jail cell in the Tesco Express. Like, I knew that they had these at like big Tescos, but the fact that they found space in like a tiny like urban Tesco for like a jail cell was very funny to me. And they were going to call the police and stuff. And then he managed to get out by the manager of the Tesco came in and he happened to have some bruises on his ribs from like falling off a skateboard or something earlier in the week. And he claimed that like the security guard had given him these bruises. So they agreed to just like let him go. No harm, no foul.
Oh, amazing.
The manager's like, you should have used a phone book. This is why we do that.
He's like, who has a phone book anymore? What am I gonna do? Go get an Argos catalog?
I once knew somebody who got caught shoplifting in a supermarket and tried to get out of it by claiming that his name was Alex Tesco and that he was
this is my birthright.
And he was a child of the Tesco family.
That would be pretty good. Well, I mean, like, it would be plausible at Sainsbury's. I am actually Master Sainsbury.
I used to work at bottle shops, liquor stores as well. Mm-hmm. And the rule is with those things and supermarkets as well, if somebody's stealing and you know it, you can speak to them and say, hey, don't steal that. Or like, oh, I'll call security or the cops or whatever. But you're not meant to physically intervene because the shops don't have the insurance to cover anything that could go wrong if you like try to stand in the person's way or whatever. And some people are very aware of that rule, and there was a certain bottle shop in a liquor land in Greensboro that I would fill in at sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I went there, the manager goes, hey, you should be aware there's a guy that comes in almost every day and he knows that's the rule and he will just grab a bottle of rum and he'll look you in the eye and say, I'm taking this, goodbye. And he did it. He absolutely did it.
Every single day. Oh, good morning, Luke. How are you doing? Yeah, I'll just be taking that.
Yeah, pretty much. You just sort of ignore it. You go, well, what am I going to do? I don't
like
care.
Like a mafia protection racket.
Yeah, I'm 19 years old. I watch this man go.
That's pretty funny just to be pricing that in.
Yeah.
It's pretty good stuff.
Well, there's the one bottle of rum every single day, so yeah. That's a part of loss.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, basically, Jerry is trying to prevent Uncle Leo from doing more shoplifting. And Jerry, the chaos demon that he is, decides that the best way to do this is by grassing Uncle Leo up to the bookstore, which is insane. That's not the way
to
go about
it. Well, he thinks they're going to give him a scare. He doesn't realize that they have a whole shoplifting policy. Oh, also, the reason that Costanza then gets exchanged for Uncle Leo at the end is because Costanza fails to return the book even to a homeless charity. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this woman before. This is the woman who tangled with Elaine over the muffin stumps.
Oh yeah, the muffin stumps.
And she has a fun line. She says she's going to leap over the counter and punch him. And Costanza tries to argue and she says, here I come. And she has such a fun time delivering that line. Like, you know, she's got like four lines in the whole thing and she's really like, you know what, I'm gonna really perform these. I'm really gonna be, you know, Judy Dench and Shakespeare in Love in this one. I'm gonna steal
here
this
I
scene.
Come is always a great line.
Yeah, I had a light lunch because I'm planning on chewing up this screen time that I have. I'm finishing every single morsel of it.
I think you should say, "Here I come before you come." I think that would be a...
And you point to where ready it's going to go. Like Babe Ruth pointing, calling his shot. This is a homer.
Yeah, yeah. imagine like meeting like a really sexy guy and going home with him and he's like really good in bed, but then he has this kind of like nursery rhyme sensibility that you didn't know about and he's like, "Ready or not, here I come."
Fee, fi, fo, fum. What? What did you just say?
yeah. Well, that guy, but he's also really anti-period sex. he's really immature about women's bodies. Or really into it.
Or really into it. Yeah, I think it could be either. Yeah. So the reason Costanza is gets done for shoplifting is because he's finally decided that since he can't return the book, he's going to steal another book as a kind of reparation.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if we can clear.
And then return that to get the money. Another classic ruse.
Classic gambit.
Steal something and return it for the cash.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Elaine has drunkenly made out with somebody at her work and to cover the embarrassment of that, claims to be in a relationship with them. And then he turns out to be, a heroin addict? Is that the implication?
Yeah. No, it's not the implication. He says it's... I think it's said in as many words.
Awesome.
There's a fun little line where Peter Minsell says, I feel guilty about this, like, because I got him, I pushed him off the wagon because I was filling his head with all these kind of glamorous stories about opium dens, and also I gave him a few numbers for where he could score near his hotel. So,
well, Elaine, he won't be working here much longer. I'm sure he'll be releasing a seminal album before too long. Before dying at the age of 27. Crazy to have achieved that much by 27.
And yeah, so Elaine sees him snogging someone else, and because she said that they're dating, she has to pretend to be really upset, and then she gets put in charge of helping him detox from heroin. And there's another kind of tying the storyline together where she manages to get him clean. She sort of puts him through the kind of the train spotting 3 days. She rings Jerry while she's doing it, which I respect a lot, because I also think that if you're going through a rough time, the best way of approaching it is to try and just drag as many people into it as possible. So like, it's not, yeah, you're never gonna feel good about it, but you can ensure that other people feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she rings Jerry and sort of says, he's kind of vomiting up everything I've given him, and he's got the sweats and he's got the kind of the heat, the general heebie-jeebies. But she manages it works. She manages to detox him and get him clean, and it shows him saying, "Hey, this is the first day of the rest of my life." And then he steps out onto the pavement and gets immediately hit by Newman in an out of control rickshaw.
It's perfect. Yeah,
which is not bad. It's not a bad tie-in. And there's also there's a nice visual joke where it turns out that Leo might go to prison for shoplifting because he has priors and it's a crime of passion, and his mother says just leave it alone.
Yeah.
And you never find out what that is. And so Jerry has this nightmare of Leo doing pull-ups with "Hello, Jerry, hello" written on his knuckles. And there's a nice running joke about Leo's "hello" fixation. So even when he's saying, "Jerry, you ratted me out," Jerry says "hello," and Leo can't, like, he has to respond. He says "hello" before he's taken off. And he calls Jerry a goody two shoes, which is fun. It's got some bits and pieces. It's got some, you know, nice kind of nice tasty bits, but it does have one big moldy bit, which is the constant jokes about homelessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Jerry is kind of a goody two shoes.
Oh,
he's
fully
a goody two shoes.
Yeah.
He's a goody two shoes.
Yeah. And
that's okay.
Depressingly so am I.
You've shoplifted. You're a badass.
I know, that's me. Yeah, I'm known as a bad boy.
the bad boy of British comedy. That's what they call. That's what they call Milo.
Yeah,
you know
me.
I'm known as a bad guy.
That's a bad boy.
A bad person.
Yeah, the
they
only
call me
crimes
the bad
like,
person of comedy.
The only crimes I commit are things where I'm like, well, obviously that should just be legal.
Yeah.
Administrative crimes. You're a white collar criminal.
I'm a vibe.
White collar makes it sound like I'm doing like Bernie Madoff shit. Yeah, how do you think I make all this money? Through my many Bernie Madoff style crimes and
just
wheezes.
Just a little mild embezzlement, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
You're a vibe based criminal. You feel it out. It's
That's
all
right.
about sensing
yeah.
it.
As it all should be.
This one's fine, I think. I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
I love right. the expression goody two shoes. I love the idea that as soon as you take off one shoe, you're like, you're a rebel. As soon as you take off that shoe, and you're hopping around.
Yeah. Well, like pirates.
Look at this by the numbers straight down the line. Rule following idiot wearing two shoes.
Wearing two shoes. Yeah. Look at me. I'm wearing three shoes.
Yeah. Whereas if you wear four shoes and run at someone like a dog, like that really freaks people out. No, they're like, keep the book.
Is that the origin? Because it's like not a pirate.
Oh.
I mean, that was just a joke, but I don't, it could be.
Not a pirate, not a dog.
The pirates were
not
so.
A furry.
That's the thing, the reason why people didn't
like
pirate.
Not a pirate and not a dog. Those are the two, those are the two things you got to tick off the list
people
before you work
like
out.
People didn't like pirates because of ableism. You know, one-handed, one-legged, one-eyed guys who were successful and society couldn't handle it.
And who speak to their parrots as well.
Yeah. Yeah, they'd have been great on TikTok, the pirates.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's what the modern pirates, like the Somali pirates and stuff, should adopt more of the aesthetics of the old school pirates, and then they would be more popular.
They need to do bigger numbers on the parrots. Bring in the parrots.
Yeah.
If they had a parrot, they would get a lot more sympathy for, you know, commandeering a container ship.
Yeah. Yeah. Too much automatic rifles, not enough parrot.
Exactly.
Come on.
Wearing a big hat and a parrot, and the parrot speaking Arabic.
Fluffy shirt, curved sword, dream.
Salaam alaikum. That's an awesome idea. Yeah, like canonically the parrot doesn't have a soul, but you know, it's still it's a valued member of the team. That's probably about as good a place as any to leave it. Remains is only to thank Luca very much for joining us.
Pleasure as always, please. Yeah. Literally any time, I'd love to come and talk for 15, 20 minutes Seinfeld, a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything you'd like to plug to the loyal hogs?
Oh, when is this out? Relatively real time?
It is going to come out like in a week and a half, so before the festival's over.
If you're in Melbourne, please see my Melbourne Comedy Festival show.
I saw it in Edinburgh. It's very good.
Nice. Oh man, it's so much better than then as well. It's got
scratch
and sniff card
I
now.
I still
you
thought
it
was good, and that was kind. Ages ago.
It's also in Hobart and Sydney if you're in those parts of Australia as well. Mm. And other than that, I don't know. Follow me on the socials. I have a podcast also.
Oh yeah, Ooh Spooky. Spooky.
It's good stuff.
With Peter Jones, who's also been on this podcast multiple times.
Beautiful. We love Peter
Jones.
So
there you go. You've got a large base of data points to draw on about whether or not you want to listen to that podcast.
You've already heard two of the three hosts. Maybe the third will ruin it. You'll have to come over and find out.
Is there a third host as well?
There is.
We're going to... Well, we have to get them on.
Can I ask, we're up to episode 17 of season 9. Does that mean this podcast almost done, or you'll move on to... something else, or just restart, or other Seinfeld based.
We're trying to work out what we're going to move on to. Yeah, the plan is to move on to something,
maybe some Curb or something like this.
Yeah, potentially. That's one of the. It's one of the contenders.
Yeah, beautiful. Can't wait to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're going to be reviewing every episode of the Ooh Spooky podcast. One more Patreon sub from us.
God,
to this shit.
This third host is a nightmare.
I can't believe it's a parrot.
Spooky.
Like a rock bar.
Tiny suicide vest on a parrot. parrot. That's a funny thought.
Just feathers.
Yeah. Well, no one could hate the Islamic State if that's what they did. Tiny, tiny suicide parrot.
You'd think they've chopped the guy's head off, but it's just sort of tucked under his wing in such a way that it's obscured.
That would be perfect. Yeah, and if you're in Australia, I'm on tour currently. Am I still? Maybe. I don't know. Depending on what date this is. I'm on tour until the 19th of April. So if it's before then, consider my dates in Sydney, Newcastle, Canberra, Adelaide and Perth. Please do sign up to the Patreon. That helps us a lot. There's a lot of good stuff on there. There's like four bonus episodes a month that you can get.
Yeah.
If you're at the top tier. So yeah. Give that a think. Give that a little
ponder
think.
It. Hold yeah. it in your mind.
Yeah, give it a little ponder. All right. Well, we will see you very, very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.